and said, this is not a solution, this is not working. Many of them do, in fact, support the idea of a single-payer Medicare for all, and that's what we need to be pushing
so
right now.
So what is the road to that from here, Dr. Wilhindler?
Well, we need to be saying that we need to go beyond the Affordable Care Act to a single-payer system. Merely trying to defend the Affordable Care Act at this point is not going to work. The American people have seen it for 3 years and rejected it. And, you know, 20 million people got insurance, and that's great, but there were 280 million people who saw no improvements in their health care. They still can't afford health care despite having private insurance because of the co-payments and the deductibles and those narrow networks. So we need to go to a system that fixes the health care system for everyone, and that's what's politically possible right now. Defending the Affordable Care Act looks like defending the status quo in health care, and that's not acceptable to most American
voters. Dr. Steffi Wilhindler, what you're saying is too important. We're going to continue the conversation after the broadcast and post online at democracynow.org. Is there a road to single payer under President Trump? This is Democracy Now! Dr. Steffi Wilhindler, founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Maggots and Men, Sunday, January 15th at 4:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Maggots and Men is an experimental film set in post-revolutionary Russia, and it tells the story of the 1921 uprising of the Kronstadt sailors with a subtext of gender anarchy. This film is a benefit for Out There Adventures, whose mission is to cultivate leadership and build community for queer youth through adventure. Again, that's Maggots and Men, Sunday, January 15th, 4:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Officials are taken for a ride by the Yes Men.
The Yes Men?
The Yes Men travel the world pulling pranks at corporate events.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Yes Men Fix the World, will play Thursday, January 12th at 7 p.m. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two guys in thrift store suits who impersonate corporate bigwigs and wreak havoc with outlandish stunts. The Yes Men impose cosmic and comic justice by any means necessary. Again, that's The Yes Men Fix the World, Thursday, January 12th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a second homeless person in Portland has died from hypothermia.
A post-election incident at OHSU has employees concerned about the institution's commitment to diversity.
The EPA has released its long-awaited cleanup plan for Portland Harbor.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 9th, 2017. I'm Charity Marchant.
And I'm Ken Jones. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency on Friday released its final cleanup order for the Portland Harbor Superfund site. The plan calls for more than $1 billion to be spent over 13 years, cleaning up the heavily contaminated river bottom and adjacent riverbanks along a 10-mile stretch of the Willamette River. The recently released final cleanup order expands the areas to be dredged from the initial draft cleanup plan that the EPA released in June of last year. That plan proposed that 167 acres be dredged while the newly released plan calls for 250 acres to be dredged. The dredging would remove 3 million cubic yards of contaminated sediment from the river bottom. In addition to the dredging, about 5 miles of the riverbanks would be capped with rocks to prevent the contaminated sediment from coming into contact with area residents. A spokesperson for the EPA stated the cleanup plan was expanded due to the public comments submitted by more than 5,300 people. 90% of those who submitted public comments called on the EPA to dredge almost 3 times more contaminated soil than the final cleanup order issued by the EPA calls for. Numerous court cases are currently underway to determine the exact amounts to be paid by more than 100 corporations and local governmental entities that are liable for the cleanup costs. The final cleanup order was issued 16 years after the Portland Harbor was designated a Superfund site. The cleanup process now moves to the remedial design phase, where the actual areas to be dredged will be determined and mapped out.
Since the election of Donald Trump, there has been a well-documented rise in racist incidents. The Southern Poverty Law Center noted 33 incidents in Oregon during the month of November alone, putting the state near the top of the list on a per capita basis. The center also pointed out that many racist incidents go unreported. In the days after the election, such an incident may have happened at OHSU. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has more.
Oregon Health and Science University has a well-deserved and long-standing commitment to inclusiveness and diversity, but a post-election incident has called that commitment into question. I spoke to Matt Hilton, president of Local 328 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, about the incident in question.
So I am president of AFSCME Local 328. We're a labor union that represents about 6,000 workers at OHSU. We have a member in our bargaining unit who had had an incident occur in September where she was with her mom and kids driving in her car, and a cyclist pepper sprayed her window and yelled some racial slurs at her, and the perpetrator was actually never caught. So she was sharing this incident with a coworker at work who had, at the time mentioned, I hate racism, yet a few days after Donald Trump was elected, she came into work to find that someone had placed a small noose near her work area, and it turned out to be this coworker. OHSU investigated the incident. Their investigation, they concluded there was no racial bias involved. Our member certainly doesn't feel that way and was so upset by the incident that she went out on short-term disability, and her doctor still doesn't feel that she's well enough to return to work on it. The individual who placed this works as a physician's assistant at OHSU. So the fact that you could have someone at that level somehow think it's appropriate to place a noose up at a workplace, especially after being told by a coworker that she'd already been a victim of a hate crime, I have a very difficult time understanding how that wouldn't be perceived as being a racist symbol.
Jenna Raymaker has been at OHSU for over 8 years as both a student and an employee. She believes that the university has missed an opportunity to reinforce its message of diversity and inclusion, and worries that others will be afraid to come forward if similar incidents occur.
I would say that what disappoints me so much about how this was handled is because I do think that OHSU is such a great university. And one of the things I've always admired about OHSU is its proclamation to this commitment of diversity and inclusion. So I think that these events probably, it's not that they don't go on here, but OHSU has always in the past had a very strong voice saying we don't allow those things to go on here and we'll stand up against them when they do. And in this case, it doesn't appear like they're standing up for the victim. And that troubled me. And it troubled me knowing that more of these events are probably going on than reported. And when a victim hears about this, I don't know how they think they can come forward when OHSU isn't standing up for them. Regardless of whether the intent of this was hateful, ignorant, or just plain stupid, I think that perception matters. And these events, a noose should never be dismissed or excused or passed up as a joke, because that's what normalizes it. And that troubles me that OHSU isn't recognizing that and condemning it and stepping in and apologizing that those events even went on campus.
OHSU President Joseph Robertson will be speaking this Friday at the University Auditorium. The event is intended to remember Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy of social justice and is sponsored by the institution's Center for Diversity. Jenna Raymaker is wondering if Robertson will take that opportunity to address the event and use it as a teaching moment. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
A second death due to inclement weather occurred in Portland over the weekend. 52-year-old Karen Batts was evicted from an apartment complex for low-income seniors this past October. She was found dead of hypothermia in a parking garage on Southwest 10th Avenue when police arrived on Saturday afternoon. Starting last Wednesday and continuing through the weekend, the American Legion Post 134 on Northeast Alberta Street offered itself as a warming center and overnight shelter for houseless people with nowhere else to escape the severe weather. According to Post 134 bar manager Seth Grant, his establishment took the initiative to help in emergency conditions without waiting for official approval. Grant said, "We hope to be a stimulus to inspire these other veteran organizations and churches to pony up, protect home and heart as they're supposed to." Grant added, "They can do this too, and some of them have a lot more space than we do." Grant said the eight people that Post 134 sheltered the first night had grown to 27 by last night, packing the space to the gills. The fire marshal and other city agencies cooperated in issuing the necessary permits and even commended the venue on stepping up to help in a crisis situation. Last week, former Governor Ted Kulongowski showed up at Post 134 and reportedly gave the coat off his back to a man sheltering there. The man didn't know who Kulongowski was and initially refused, but ended up taking the coat and a pair of gloves and expressing gratitude for them. With another snowstorm and 16-degree temperatures forecast for the middle of the week, Post 134 plans to offer shelter again starting Wednesday. At press time, they were requesting further donations going into this week. You can visit them on Facebook or at www.post134.com, or you can call 503-284-7272 to arrange drop-offs. Anyone requiring emergency shelter or other services is urged to call 211 or check online at 211info.org to see what's available.
Amnesty International is leading a last-minute plea to President Obama to close Guantanamo with an open letter posted on their website, and public actions are planned nationwide for this Wednesday. The date marks the opening of the Guantanamo Bay detention camp 15 years ago by George W. Bush. A rally in March will kick off at 11 a.m. this Wednesday in Washington, D.C. The local solidarity event in Portland will run from 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. Wednesday at the east end of the Hawthorne Bridge at Southeast Hawthorne and Grand. Co-sponsors of the event include Peace and Justice Works, the Portland Close Guantanamo Coalition, Jewish Voice for Peace, PDX, and Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. Last month, Obama told the world it was, quote, past time to shut down the detention facility, and as his administration appeared in a rush to transfer as many as possible of the 60 remaining prisoners out of Gitmo before Trump takes office.
Confirmation hearings for the post of Attorney General of the U.S. are due to begin tomorrow. President-elect Donald Trump's pick for the job, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, has been one of the most hard-line voices in Congress against immigration reform and was famously denied a seat as a federal judge over concerns of racial bias. As Attorney General, Sessions would be in charge of upholding the nation's civil rights code and of prosecuting federal immigration law infractions. In advance of next week's confirmation hearings, more than 1,100 law professors from around the country have signed a letter to Congress expressing their rejection of the senator's probable appointment to the post. FSRN's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with University of Denver law professor Robin Walker Sterling, one of the letter's organizers and authors.
Professor Walker Sterling, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with FSRN. So tell us about this letter to Congress that you've helped organize.
As our country's top law enforcement officer, right, Senator Sessions would be charged with basically safeguarding civil rights across a lot of different realms. And so in the course of talking with law professor colleagues, we thought that it might both mobilize our community and send a strong message if we wrote and got people to sign on to a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee expressing our concerns about the choice of Senator Sessions to be our country's top law enforcement officer. And at this point, there are more than 1,100 signatures on this letter?
Yes. The last I checked it, there were 1,140. And we now have representation from every state except Alaska, which does not have a law school. We had 1,000 or close to 1,000 within 72 hours.
Share with us some of the specific concerns voiced in the letter.
In particular, we mentioned his history of questionable racial ideas. Of course, when he was nominated for the federal bench in 1986, his candidacy ultimately failed because of allegations that he was racist. And was racist not just in his attitudes, but that he was racist in his actions as well. I haven't seen the kind of growth or change that you might expect in all his years in the Senate, particularly considering he's been in the Senate for many, many years, has an enormous amount of influence, and has had time to build relationships and respect. Considering that, you would expect to see a lot more movement on questions of civil rights and civil liberties than his record demonstrates. I think that the lack of demonstrable advances in that area show where his priorities lie.
How serious do you believe the ramifications would be if Jeff Sessions is appointed Attorney General?
Well, I think that there would be ramifications on a lot of different levels. The main thing that Senator Sessions as Attorney General does is it sends a signal to large parts of the population that this will not be an administration that tends to the issues and concerns of everyone in the country. As he settles into the post, I can only imagine that what we would see is a retrenchment in all sorts of damaging areas, right? Maybe a return to stop and frisk, or and broken windows policing, a retreat on serious discussion about the importance of strengthening indigent public defense in our country, on not using criminal and municipal courts as revenue-generating enterprises. So, right, like having them actually be places where justice is meted out instead of where money is raised for, you know, all sorts of municipal and other needs. I would expect a retrenchment on juvenile delinquency issues in particular, not to mention concerning voting rights, which I think are right at the forefront of our civil rights issues today. Although Senator Sessions voted in favor of reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act 10 years ago, he celebrated when the Supreme Court gutted it in 2013. That's tremendously troubling.
And can you explain specifically how that could happen, as far as how he could utilize the power he would have as Attorney General to bring about those rollbacks in civil rights defenses?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly one of the main ways that the Obama Justice Department has created an environment for change or new understanding of what specific our criminal justice system should look like is by doing investigations of specific police departments and specific county municipal courts to illuminate practices that in those areas that may have led to disproportionate or punitive policing, right? So that kind of deep investigation and collecting data about the problem is what is able to push the conversation forward.
What are your hopes for Congress's response to the concerns you voiced in this letter and that are also being voiced by other individuals and organizations like the NAACP?
Well, of course, if he were to not be confirmed, that'd be great. But recognizing that that's a long shot, given his long years in the Senate and the reputation that he has among his colleagues who will be confirming him. I would, at the very least, hope that this means that the confirmation hearings are not just rubber stamp proceedings, that they're, in fact, searching, rigorous inquiry into his opinions on the core values, the ideals that in fact make us American, right? Because we should know. We don't deserve any less as American citizens. We need to know what our Attorney General thinks about those things. Also, I would hope that this sends a message that in the event that he is confirmed, there are legions of folks around the country who are on watch, right? And for all of us who signed this letter, we are, you know, law professors, so we spend all our waking hours and some of our sleeping ones thinking about the law and reading about it and learning about it and imagining what it means for the law to live and breathe and reflect the better angels of all our natures. And we try to teach our students that. We teach them to take it very seriously, being a lawyer, because you become a steward of the law. So he needs to know that we are on the job.
Robin Walker Sterling is a law professor at the University of Denver and an organizer of an effort by law professors nationwide to oppose the confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions to the post of Attorney General of the United States. For FSRN, I'm Hanley Myers.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 and Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for scattered showers with temperatures in the mid-40s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect a partly cloudy day with temperatures in the mid-30s and snow beginning in the afternoon, continuing through the night. 1 to 3 inches are expected. On this date, in 1776, Thomas Paine published Common Sense, a scathing attack on King George's reign over the colonies and a call for independence. Today's quote is from Paine, who said, "Government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. In its worst state, an intolerable one."
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Fiat Chrysler's announcement that it's investing $1 billion in Ohio and Michigan auto plants is being embraced by the United Auto Workers Union. UAW President Dennis Williams says it shows Fiat Chrysler's commitment to the United States, to UAW members and their employees. The UAW says the announcement confirms ongoing discussions the UAW has been having with Fiat Chrysler. The union says the investment will benefit UAW members and their families by providing greater job security and a world-class manufacturing environment. The AFL-CIO says Congress should abandon plans for the reckless repeal of the Affordable Care Act without providing an immediate replacement. Approximately 20 million people have insurance through the Affordable Care Act that they will lose if it's repealed.
Donald Trump's choice to head the Department of Education is the antithesis of public education and all it represents. And it's the antithesis of what our kids need.
American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, speaking at the National Press Club Monday, the AFT and the National Education Association are opposing the nomination of billionaire Betsy DeVos as federal education secretary. The teachers' unions say DeVos is an ideological extremist intent on defunding and undermining public education in America.
She hasn't taught in a public school. She hasn't served on a school board. She never attended a public school, nor did she send her kids to one. The most anti-public education nominee in the history of the department. Her drive to privatize education is demonstrably destructive to public schools and to the education success of all of our children.
Striking Momentum workers will be back at the bargaining table for sessions January 10th, 11th, and 12th. IUE CWA Local 81359 has been on strike for more than 2 months. Issues include health care, retiree benefits, and 401ks. Local President Dominic Patrignani told local TV Channel 13 that strike solidarity is strong with support from other unions and the community.
We're in this for the long haul, folks. We're in this to take on corporate greed and to try to do whatever we could to get a fair contract for our members.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org. Brought to you by Union Active, your certified iOS and Android mobile app developer, offering high-quality, union-made mobile apps backed by a support team which upgrades your product to every new mobile operating system. Features, pricing, and examples are online at unionactive.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
For Meryl Streep, last night's Golden Globes Awards ceremony was not just another gracious acceptance speech. After accepting a Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award, the actress used the opportunity to denounce President-elect Donald Trump as a bully and to stress the increasing importance of a free and independent press. She referred specifically to the Trump rally, where the candidate mimicked disabled New York Times reporter Sergei F. Kovaleski and said, quote, "It kind of broke my heart when I saw it, and I still can't get it out of my head, because it wasn't in a movie. It was real life." She then urged people to join her in supporting the Committee to Protect Journalists and said, quote, "We need the principled press to hold power, to account, to call them on the carpet for every outrage." Meryl Streep is one of the most recognized actresses of our time. She has received 19 Academy Award nominations and 23 Golden Globe nominations, both records. She has also received the Presidential Medal of Freedom and has been awarded an honorary Doctorate of Arts by Princeton, Harvard, and Yale universities. Trump responded to Streep's comments in typical fashion, tweeting that she was one of the most overrated actresses in Hollywood and, quote, "a Hillary flunky who lost big."
On Saturday, the FBI arrested the former top emissions compliance manager for Volkswagen's American operations. The arrest warrant was issued after regulators discovered Volkswagen installed software that allowed their diesel engine cars to cheat emission tests. The car's engines ran cleaner when hooked up to the emission testing equipment than under normal driving conditions when the cars emitted up to 40 times the legal limit for diesel emissions. VW has already agreed to pay up to $16 billion to settle civil lawsuits in America, and the final U.S. Justice Department fine is expected to be more than $2 billion. The executive, Oliver Schmidt, was arrested Saturday in Florida and is expected to be arraigned today in Detroit, Michigan.
Bolivia has been in the midst of a major water crisis for more than a year now. Residents of the city of La Paz are under strict rationing rules. Glaciers are melting at an alarming pace. What was once the country's second largest lake has dried up, but some would argue that a major factor behind the crisis is an economic model that prioritizes the needs of resource-thirsty industries over those of ordinary citizens. Mining operations are guzzling away at rivers, and now the government has plans to construct so-called mega dams in the Amazon region to generate hydroelectric power for export. Indigenous communities in the dam's paths are teaming up with environmentalists and civil society organizations to stop the project in their tracks. Aldo Orellana Lopez has more.
The Bolivian government has revived a long-dormant plan to turn the Amazon region into an energy hub. The plan calls for the construction of two large hydroelectric dams on the Beni River and infrastructure to export the power generated to neighboring countries. President Evo Morales estimates the project would cost around $6 billion and, once operational, would bring in more than $1 billion a year. But indigenous communities in the region of the planned project say they are unwilling to pay the human cost of the so-called megadams. They also warn the environmental impact would be staggering due to the role of water cycles in the Amazon region's complex ecosystem. Sara La Paz is an expert in protected natural reserves.
The Amazon is a delicate ecoregion that greatly depends on its balance of water, on the course of its rivers, and on the places where that water pools. These are areas within the national system of protected areas. These are also areas protected by their own indigenous communities, because those communities depend on the well-being and balance of the ecosystems within those territories.
According to a leaked environmental impact assessment, the two dams will flood an area larger than the city of La Paz, affecting around 4,000 people in 17 communities within and near the flood zone. Indigenous Timanes, Tacanas, Mosetenes, and Uchupiamonas wrongly reject the project, saying it never went through the formal consultation required by the country's constitution and international accords. While Bolivia is no longer the second poorest nation in the hemisphere, The Morales administration's economic policy relies heavily on natural resource extraction, which has repeatedly caused confrontation with indigenous communities in resource-rich areas. Alex Vilca is a spokesperson for the Amazon Defense Coordinating Committee.
At this moment, we as indigenous peoples are in resistance mode and demanding that the Bolivian government bring the policies it has adopted in line with our current laws. We have a constitution with multiple articles that back up and support the rights of indigenous peoples.
Others have raised questions about the financial viability of the megadam project. Some analysts warn the cost of building two dams and transmission lines to neighboring countries will likely cost far more than $6 billion. Marco Gandarillas, director of the Bolivian Center for Information and Investigation, CEDIP, says the project is unlikely to be profitable due to high costs and energy market volatility.
The Bolivian government believes the era of gas has passed and that few reserves are likely to be discovered. They have little hope of finding huge reserves and are thus concentrating on a very aggressive plan to build at least 17 hydroelectric projects, many of them with the intent of expanding upon energy exports.
Last November, residents of indigenous communities near the plant sites along the Beni River issued alerts about the arrival of heavy equipment of the company hired by the government to make the final studies to build the dams. They immediately began round-the-clock vigils in the area, and the company withdrew its equipment weeks later. The government has yet to comment on the incident, but has said many times it plans to move ahead with the project to build the dams. Aldo Orellana López, FSRN, La Paz, Bolivia.
On Friday, the Obama administration announced it has rejected 6 permit applications to conduct seismic blasting in the Atlantic Ocean. Oil and gas companies use seismic blasting to map natural deposits of oil and gas beneath the seabeds. When in operation, the air gun blasting can be heard up to 2,500 miles away. The blasts are fired every 12 seconds, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for months on end. The Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which issued the order denying the permits, determined that the blasting significantly increased the mortality rates of nearby whales and other marine species. The federal agency determined that for just one species alone, the sperm whale, an officially designated endangered species, the blasting would harass or harm the whales nearly 85,000 times over a 5-year period. The agency estimates that up to 25% of the world's sperm whale population has already suffered permanent hearing loss from the exploratory blasting. Sperm whales depend on their hearing to hunt, navigate, and communicate with each other. Hundreds of other marine species are similarly harmed by the blasting. The order against exploratory seismic blasting only applies to operations in the Atlantic Ocean.
Angry protests over the 20% hike in gasoline prices, known as gasolinazo, have plunged parts of Mexico into chaos. Protesters are marching in the streets and blocking highways, petrol stations, and installations of the state-run oil giant Pemex. More than 250 stores have been looted amid allegations that paid agitators infiltrated the protests. The gasolinazo sparked the protest, but analysts say social unrest has been building for months. The Mexican peso has been steadily dropping in value while threats from U.S. President-elect Trump have sowed disarray in the country's economy. Mexico's minimum wage is just $4 a day, and people are so sensitive to price increases that hikes in the cost of public transportation are one of the principal reasons high school students abandon classes, according to the public education secretary. On Monday, the Mexican government announced that inflation had hit a 2-year high of 3.36%. Even before the increase in fuel prices was announced, long lines had formed at pumps around the country due to shortages attributed to theft from pipelines, poor distribution, and alleged hoarding by stations.
Over 140 million people have been forced to flee their homes due to climate-related disasters since 2010. The UN predicts one of every 30 people in the world could become a climate refugee by 2050. The past 3 years have been consecutively the hottest year on record on Earth. The climate crisis tends to exacerbate the most vulnerable regions in the world through drought and desertification. While richer countries such as the U.S. and Russia are responsible for the bulk of world emissions, it's typically poor countries such as Lebanon that accept the most refugees. Political discourse regarding refugees tends to have a xenophobic tone in wealthier nations. Europe will be holding its first conference on the climate refugee crisis next month, and the less developed world is not alone in feeling climate change's effects. The U.S. relocated its first official climate refugees just last spring. A Native American tribe in Louisiana has lost 98% of its land to rising sea levels and pipeline development in the Gulf of Mexico. Louisiana has lost roughly 2,000 miles of coastline since the 1930s and continues to lose a football field-sized stretch every hour.
And now it's news headlines from our friends at Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following was produced by the Drug Policy Alliance in an effort to prevent the nomination or swearing in of Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions as Attorney General of these United States.
Sessions is a throwback to a shameful era, which I know both black and white Americans thought was in our past.
America incarcerates more people than any other country on earth. 57% of those arrested on drug charges are black or Latino, even though white people use and sell drugs at the same rate or even higher than people of color. We have to do everything we can to stop Sessions.
Jeff Sessions represents my state, Alabama, where more than 31% of all black people are denied the right to vote.
Jeff Sessions was fine with the terrorist hate group, the KKK, until he learned that they smoked pot.
I may have said something like that. Send that message with clarity that good people don't smoke marijuana.
Marijuana is a leading cause of deportation. My father was a legal tax-paying resident who was deported. Jeff Sessions will destroy more families.
I have an 18-year-old son who plays the trumpet and loves math. It's not fair to have to worry about his life every single day because he's a young black man who's a stop-and-frisk target.
Jeff Sessions is one of the scariest possibilities that I was afraid of.
Jeff Sessions wants to ramp up a drug war that costs us $50 billion a year, and yet most Americans believe that it's failed.
He is, I believe, a disgrace to the Justice Department, and he should withdraw his nomination and resign his position.
Jeff Sessions is simply unfit. If you believe in fairness, if you believe in due process, if you believe in our Constitution, you must join me in the fight to stop Sessions.
He's been wrong on the drug war. He's been wrong on criminal justice. He's been wrong on civil rights and liberties, and he's wrong on America.
I'm too young to vote, so I need you to speak for me. Please stop Jeff Sessions.
This message courtesy of the Drug Policy Alliance, drugpolicy.org. The petition reads in part that Sessions is likely to use his power as Attorney General to interfere with state legal marijuana and medical marijuana programs. He's also a proponent of harsh sentences for drug offenses and was the chief opponent of recent bipartisan efforts to reduce sentences for drug offenses. Quoting him, this proposal would provide for leniency for illegal alien drug traffickers. The DPA's petition closes with the thought that Jeff Sessions is not fit to serve as Attorney General. And as your constituent, I am strongly urging you to oppose his nomination. Again, that's at drugpolicy.org. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
On Sunday in Jerusalem, a Palestinian man was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers after driving a truck through a crowd of Israeli soldiers. Four soldiers were killed and 15 others injured when they were hit by the truck. The driver, who was killed by multiple gunshot wounds to the head, was a 20-year-old former political prisoner from East Jerusalem. An Israeli bus driver who had been driving the soldiers on a tour of East Jerusalem told the Daily Mail that he emptied his entire magazine into the windshield of the truck. Several others also fired, killing the Palestinian driver. At least a dozen bullet holes can be seen in photos of the windshield of the truck. Israeli police have detained nine of the driver's relatives, according to Israeli media. In a meeting of the Israeli Security Cabinet following the attack, the Israeli government decided to demolish the man's home. This act was condemned by human rights groups as collective punishment. Israel is the only country that routinely demolishes the homes of the family members of someone who has committed a crime, essentially punishing every family member, including children, for the action of one individual. The Security Cabinet also decided to order the military to carry out an aggressive campaign across the West Bank and Jerusalem. to search out any Palestinian that has expressed support for or admiration of Daesh, known by the acronym ISIS, even if they have never engaged in any crime or attack. In addition, the military was ordered to blockade the Jabal Mukaber neighborhood next to the site of the attack. The neighborhood is one of several in East Jerusalem that was marked for annexation by Israeli authorities as part of the E1 plan to rid East Jerusalem of its indigenous Palestinian inhabitants and transfer Jewish Israelis into the area. This past August, Israeli Public Security Manager Gilad Erdan announced a wide-scale Israeli police presence and surveillance apparatus for Jabal Mukaber and other targeted Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. He made clear that the reason for the increase in police surveillance was the takeover of the area for the Jewish state, stating, quote, "Our national sovereignty begins by exercising our sovereignty over Jerusalem."
An iceberg the size of Delaware is set to break off from the Larsen Sea ice shelf in the Antarctica within the next few months. When it breaks away from the Larsen Sea shelf, it will form one of the largest icebergs ever recorded at more than 1,900 square miles. The iceberg is being created by a miles-long rift that is growing rapidly and is set to break off the iceberg from the remaining ice shelf. The rift grew by 11 miles in December alone, and only 12 miles remains before the iceberg breaks completely away from its shelf. Scientists believe that could happen within the next few months. While the part of the ice shelf set to calf is already floating and as such won't by itself raise ocean levels, it acts as a bound to the ocean. The nearby Larsen A and B ice shelves both collapsed in the last 20 years, and research showed that as ice shelves collapse, the speed with which glaciers flow into the ocean greatly increases, and this does contribute to an ocean level rise. The Larsen Sea ice shelf is the fourth. It's the largest in the Antarctica region, and if the entire ice shelf were to collapse, ocean levels would rise by 10 feet worldwide. Scientists believe that once the iceberg breaks free, it will fundamentally and permanently change the landscape of Antarctica and destabilize both the remaining area of the Larsen Sea ice shelf and the adjoining glaciers.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Tony LaTigra, and Jake Randall. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Charity Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Charity Marchand. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Joe and Abe take your calls. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Richard Wolff looks at Trumponomics. At 10, Chris Andrea hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, on stage in studio, DeMay Roberts brings you the 9th annual Fertile Grounds Festival of New Works, featuring over 100 new performances around Portland. And at 11:30 on Arts Focus, Andre Middleton asks, how do we train a political body? A look at the Cooper Albright Workshop. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Good night, Charity.
Good night,
Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
America's real migrant crisis is the one you've never heard of. That's the title of a recent article in Mother Jones' article about thousands of migrants from the Micronesian islands currently living in poverty in Hawaii. And it's mostly due to a somewhat obscure 30-year-old treaty called COFA, the Compact of Free Association. KBOO's Kanan Schlesinger spoke with Aaron Weiner, the article's author, as well as senior editor at Mother Jones, to find out more.
Can you talk a little bit about COFA and what the historical backdrop of this migration crisis is?
Sure. So the story really starts 70 years ago, back when the U.S. conducted some nuclear tests in the Pacific, and they selected the Bikini Atoll and the Marshall Islands as a place where they thought they could do it without a lot of disturbance, and dislocated a lot of people who were living there. And it sort of started this pattern of disruption and migration that continued over the decades. And the present arrangement between the U.S. and the three Micronesian states we're talking about was codified starting in 1986, 30 years ago, when they signed this COFA deal, the Compact of Free Association, that established this special relationship between the United States and, at first, two Micronesian countries, the Federated States of Micronesia and the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and then later Palau as well. And basically said the U.S. could continue its military dominion over this large chunk of the Pacific Ocean. And in exchange, the U.S. will give some aid to these countries, and residents of these three Micronesian countries can come to the U.S. freely to live and work without a visa. It's kind of a unique privilege. You know, the impact was pretty small for a long time. There just weren't that many people coming over. But then in the past couple of decades, and really the past several years, it's picked up a lot, and it's led to the present situation.
And so the title of your article is America's Real Migrant Crisis. Is the one you've never heard of. Why do you refer to it as, I guess, real migrant crisis? Is that just like in relation to the ones that are getting more attention in bigger news outlets?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, there has been a lot of hype about various groups of migrants and immigrants. We have, you know, we've heard a lot during the presidential campaign about the role, you know, of Mexicans coming into the country and the things that they're allegedly doing. And the dangers posed by Syrian refugees coming into America, and you know those dangers haven't really materialized. It's a lot of political talk, but we haven't really seen this mass threat that's been described or anything like that. By contrast, there's this thing that no one's really talking about here on the mainland, and I should say it's quite well known in Hawaii because people are seeing the implications of it all over the place. But here on the mainland, hardly anyone that I've spoken with has even heard of this situation or the COFA treaty.